be honest, I thought I was going to start a conversion therapy group myself. Like, I thought the whole reason I went into those gay relationships was because God was trying to teach me how to get out of it so then I could lead this ex-gay ministry. I honestly thought I was going to run that in New Zealand. So I had a lot of stuff to work through. Stick true to being authentic because it's worth it in the end.
Kia ora koutou and welcome to Revolving Door Syndrome. I'm Dr. Nina Su, your friendly neighbourhood paediatric and emergency doctor. My day job is helping sick kids get better. But lately, I felt like I'm pushing a revolving door round and round in circles. I patch these kids up, send them back to the environment that made them sick in the first place, and they come right back through those hospital doors again. Together with my partner Connor, we've created this podcast to deep dive into the reasons for our broken systems and perhaps find some real solutions. This podcast was made in association with the School of Medicine, University of Auckland. On this episode of Revolving Door Syndrome, we pick up where we left off with Dr. Ari Chuang. On part two of this two-part series, we discuss gender-affirming care and barriers to access for trans and gender-diverse people. It's the whole thing with the umbrella term of LGBTQIA+, right, is that although we have this rainbow pride flag and everything, it's like, sexuality and gender diverse and stuff, it's still different, right? Yeah. You've done a lot of different types of coming out and they were different every time.
Yeah, so I guess trans, that's kind of where my journey is. And I would have said that I started socially transitioning last year, so like it's different. I don't know if you already, like, you know, but maybe your podcast people would like to know this, but there are different types of transitioning. So I guess it can be social, legal, medical, surgical are the four main topics. And it's been really good for me to learn that all of them are valid. I think as someone who is an all or nothing person, I naturally gravitate towards, oh my God, do I then have to be like surgery, like everything. But actually recognizing that there's so many people on different journeys and some people are completely fine with just like a social transition, whether or not it's just a social name change and pronoun change and dressing differently and that's it. And that's completely valid as a trans man, as well as someone who wants to go the whole nine yards and have top and bottom surgery and everything else. Yeah. Interestingly for me, I think I didn't originally think about doing a medical transition. I think I always thought I wanted to, but it took me a few months to get to that point. I'm over that point now where I've been referred for medical transitioning. Again, when I first started this journey, I didn't really think about surgical transitioning either. But now it's like, yeah, the more I see like Elliot Page, I'm just like, I just want to be like you, dude. Yeah, I don't have, I hate my boobs. Like I don't feel that. But it's really interesting that the more I feel male presenting, like I went and bought my first suit, like I wear male cologne now, things like that. And yeah, nowadays when I do look at my chest, I do sometimes go, like, wish that wasn't there. And it's interesting that I feel that because it's never actually been an issue for me up until now. So yeah, like essentially walking through this journey kind of quite publicly, because like when I got back to work, one thing that really triggered me was people still thought of me as she and Ariel. And obviously, like, they're not my friends on Facebook, so they're not going to know that I'm decided that I'm now trans. Yeah, and so actually one of my consultants in ED, her daughter just came out as non-binary, and so we had dinner together, and she was really nice and saying, do you want me to email the department, the bosses, and let them know? I think this would be really helpful for you. So I was like, yeah, that would be good. And ever since then, every single boss has called me Ari, and that's really great. You know, there's no, like, Ariel, oh, sorry. I still slip up on pronouns all the time, but I think, again, that's just a continual process. But even like people in HR at work have been quite supportive of this transition and kind of going, how can we as a DHB help, which has been quite nice. So like, for example, them telling me they'll give me leave if I need to go to like endocrine appointments or like whatever. I was a bit cheeky and sort of said to them, do you know what? I just read in the paper that ANZ have now decided to give their staff members 6 weeks gender-affirming leave. I think this is something that you guys could consider. You know, I said, I mean, maybe necessarily not for myself, but I would love it if it was. Like, for example, if I decide to do top surgery next year, like I won't have to use up sick leave and annual leave for recovery. Like, how amazing would that be? And it's not going to be a leave that you would be giving out to everyone, because I mean, who else is transitioning in this DHB? Like, no one knows anyone else. So it's just me. But where I'm at in the journey. And I think there's hesitancy I have is I haven't told my mum or my family, and I don't know how to. I don't know. I haven't crossed that bridge yet, but I think especially when I start medically transitioning, it's something that obviously is not reversible. So it's a huge deal. And for me, part of what I'm really working through at the moment is how much of this hesitancy that's in me is just nervousness about doing something major. Will I really feel more like myself? Or like, why am I wanting to do this? Or am I going to regret it, especially if it means really destroying my relationship with my mum? And does that even matter? These are all the questions that I have to deal with. But I guess the thing I get going back to is like the friends who have really accepted me being trans. And, you know, like sometimes like someone just says to me, oh, hello, handsome. I'm like, oh, that's really affirming. Like, and I feel so much euphoria. And I'm like, oh my God, I really am. Yay. I really am trans. Like I have to be like, you know. I think I have to go and stick back to what my gut feeling is. When I have the moments I have euphoria are genuinely like moments where I'm completely seen as who I am. And I go, like, that must be the right decision. But of course, 20 years of cult-like psychosis means that it is hard to sometimes not have those voices coming in my head going, you have now really walked away from God. Like, you are trans and like you brought a child into all of this. Like, you are just beyond saving. And yeah, coming to the point where I have to go, actually, beyond saving is okay with me. Like, actually, I bring it back to, I want to model a life of authenticity for my son. If anything, I just want him to know that he can be anything he wants to be. And I want him to grow up knowing that he is free to do whatever he wants to, as long as he loves people, he loves himself, and he takes care of the world. And that's still what the Bible says, right? Love yourself as you love your neighbor, and love this world that we're put into, and love God, I guess. But if I can't be brave and do these hard things, like, I've often thought, are people going to be like, who are you, when I pick him up? Because he's not going to look Asian, and they're going to think I'm the nanny or the caregiver, you know? And in some ways, I was super glad he's got 3/4 white blood in him, except he looks like a sepia version of me. Like, he looks so much like me, it's ridiculous, just with like blonde hair. And it's great. Like, all his mannerism is completely like me, and we have no idea how, but I'll take it. I used to have a lot of reservations, I think, about having children as a same-sex couple, you know, at that time, because my mum always drilled it into me, a child needs a father and mother, and one regret I have in life is I didn't stay with your father, and that's why you turn out gay.
Well, now you're a dad, so.
Yeah, exactly. So he does have both. I've just learned that actually with kids, like, they understand more than we give them credit for. We had decided that my name was going to be Mummy at the time, and Sean's going to be Mama. And that was fine. And then he was born and came into the world. And I still remember writing on the birth certificate, I didn't know if I wanted to tick the mother box. Like, it was just a really weird feeling when I was like, I'm looking at this birth certificate in front of me going like, I don't actually feel like a mother. And then when people keep asking me, how's motherhood? I was like, I really don't feel like a mother, like, but I don't know what I feel like. So I would just say parent. And I was going to tick parent on the form. But then, because I'm an activist, I was like, well, you didn't fight for same-sex rights just for me to put parents. So I should put mother, because like, that's the whole like huge deal about it, right?
Right, so on a birth certificate now you can actually say mother and mother.
Yeah, exactly. So that was why I was like, for the sake of legal rights and fighting for all this, all people who've done this previously, I should just tick mother. But yeah, it was interesting. It was actually parenthood that made me really realize I do not identify as a mother at all. And then when we changed my name to Bubba, after a couple of months, and I think it was just me adjusting to this whole, like, I really didn't really feel like dad yet, but for some reason Bubba just felt like a good kind of midway. I was dad in Chinese, but also reclaiming my cultural heritage and like all those other stuff. And then recently he's just started calling me dad, so he just says dad all the time. It's so cute, because I'd be like, can you say mama? He'd be like, dad. And a kid and Edie called me dad the other day as well. So like, I was like, oh, maybe I am male presenting enough. They're like, daddy. I'm like, oh, sweetheart.
That's why children are the best. Come to pediatrics.
Yeah, I might be swayed. I think I'm genuinely really loving the interactions and Edie with the kids.
What's it like in terms of the legal stuff? Like, have you done any of the legal stuff to transition as well?
I haven't yet. Actually, only last year in about January did I add Ariel to my name change, like officially. I'm just a thrifty Asian. I don't really want to pay for that again. Yeah. And I think part of me was also thinking, do I just want to keep Ariel as my legal name and Ari can be like a nickname? But the conversations I've had with my family recently have been that actually the more I think about it, the more Ariel is actually more a dead name for me. Like, it's interesting that now when people say it, it makes me feel like, oh, that's actually not me anymore. So I think eventually I definitely will legally change it. I hear that apparently Auckland University pay for name changes for people who are going through gender information. I'm thinking about, because I'm doing a PEDS paper next semester, so I was like, oh, maybe I'll just do that and change it there. But I don't really know about changing like the sex on the, or gender on the passports and things, just because I don't have a New Zealand birth certificate either. So I have to look into that. I definitely feel like I would like to, and I will at some point in time.
And you were mentioning before about the like medical transition. Is it very permanent, the medical transition, if you were starting like hormone treatment and things like that?
Yeah, I think it depends on like the dosages you use. So some people can choose like low dose testosterone and transition a bit slower. They're definitely irreversible things, facial hair, voice changes and all that, and muscle balance structure. They are probably irreversible, and things like a period and things, for 80% of people that seizures, which would be amazing if it cancelled me, because that's just one thing I really don't like. But for example, if you come off tea, then that can come back. So there's definitely some things that are going to be a lot more visible than not.
And is there like a time duration kind of thing, you know, how long you have to be on hormone treatment before it becomes more permanent or less permanent? The reason why I'm asking is because there's a lot of people out there who, I don't really want to call somebody an anti-trans person just for them having different views. Like, they just don't understand.
Yeah,
right?
They haven't met anyone
who haven't had exposure or haven't met people who are trans, you know, or have strong views because of the upbringing that they've had. Like, don't understand your story, right? And the ignorance to know that someone like you, like many trans people, probably knew or had an inkling that they were trans for a very long time, but for different reasons haven't been able to make that transition until now. You were 35, right? Went through like a lot of stuff, so you didn't have time to transition back then.
No.
There are a lot of people who are afraid of overexposure to transness for like young people. I don't know too much about gender affirming care in terms of the medical transition, but it's my understanding is that there's increasing access to things like puberty blockers. So young people are able to delay puberty so that they can make decisions when they're a little bit older, like say 16, because, you know, you can't stop puberty forever because there are long lasting issues if you take puberty blockers for too long, because it can, I think, mess with like your bone strength and things like that. And everyone does have to, you know, do puberty at some point, whether or not that's something we want.
Apparently,
right?
I have to go through a second one. So yay me.
And I think a lot of people argue is that, no, it's very like permanent. And I'm like, yes, but trans kids who kill themselves, that's pretty permanent too.
Yeah. And so is like plastic surgery for cosmetic reasons. Transitioning as an adult is slightly different to transitioning as a teenager, because you talked about the hormone blockers. And from my kind of understanding of it, the blockers are reversible and they have to then go on something else. And so things like a deeper voice, growth of hair, you do apparently get like growth of sort of external genitalia. Lots of people talk about like their genitalia is changing on T, and like muscle, what does this say, scalp hair loss. Great. So I'm gonna I should have read this before I decided. No,
gotta take the good with the bad though.
Yeah, so those four things, my friends who've done this slide have underlined as being things that are irreversible. And so expected onset will be 3 to 12 months for most of them. And expected maximum effect is usually about a year or two for them. Yeah. So the reversible things would be like fat redistribution, muscle, mood changes to sex drive and function, skin changes. Yeah, those things would be the reversible things, I suppose, if we're talking about testosterone specifically. So yeah, I was told by my therapist that I will have to be prepared to go through a second puberty in case I go into a rage. So I said, well, my first puberty, I went to Botswana as a 15-year-old, so I didn't rage very much, hopefully.
Without your insulin refrigerator.
I know, I was trying to save the world. So I hope that my second puberty is going to be much the same.
Well, maybe you'll save even more of the world. Who knows?
Yeah, maybe. I think what you said was very accurate. Like, I didn't have a model of what trans people, you know, the ones I did know had other mental disorders, to be honest. So they were all a bit weird, for a lack of generalizing word. And so I never identified as that. It wasn't like I was like cross-dressing. Or what media and TV have done is recently starting to portray a lot more trans people on screen, and also people who are, all intents and purposes, just living a normal life. And I think that's where I started going, actually, it's not a medical problem. It's not a mental illness. It's not actually a problem. It is just who I am, and normalizing it to, it's actually just who I am. And like I said, if I think about it in the ways of, if someone can go and get breast surgery just to enhance their breast shape and whatever, then, you know, what? Why can I not have surgery to remove them? Isn't it essentially the same kind of thing? So why is cosmetic surgical procedures, or anything cosmetic to make ourselves look better or to make ourselves look the way we want, why is it acceptable? But somehow being trans is lumped into you just not thinking, you're not thinking straight. My wife was just saying to me the other day, she's like, even when I first knew you, you were watching videos of trans people. Like, you obviously have been thinking about this for a long time. And I'm like, yeah, I probably have. I think I just didn't feel the desire to have to come out again. I didn't have a good coming out the first time. And even though I was along that line of like, as long as people know my story and I'm still just the same old me, like I still want to do all the same things. I just happened to also like women. I gave people benefit of the doubt to listen to my story and be changed. And unfortunately, that wasn't the case with me. But it's them. They've lost out on a good friend, I think. Totally. They've lost out on opening their worldview. I continue telling my story because it's like, yeah, it will help someone out there understand. Just like I told my HR department at work, in a good mental space now to be able to be that person, I say, if you do know anyone else going through wanting to transition in a hospital, like, I'm more than happy to be a support person for that. I'm muddling my way through it, but it's always nice to know you're not alone.
Yeah,
you know,
totally. At the end of the day. It's so awesome of you to do that. Sharing the stories is so important, right? Because like my parents, for example, they Chinese immigrants came here, I don't know, 30-ish years ago or something. And they haven't, in their own lives, haven't had a lot of exposure to people who are LGBTQ or anything like that, right? Like their exposure to LGBTQ is through my friends. I had quite a few gay friends and they've met all of them and they've never said anything about being like homophobic or anything like that. And I remember one time my mum had said, this is like a few years after they'd met my friends from like university and stuff, and they're like, oh, we didn't really think much about people who are gay or not gay, whatever, but having met your friends and how great they are, we just think, you know, everyone should just be able to love whoever they want. And I was just like, that's just so beautiful for my mum to just like
reflect on that,
say that, you know. And this is a conversation that I had with my partner recently. Do your parents know that you're bisexual? And I was like, oh no, because like I haven't had like a serious relationship with a woman before, so I haven't. And this is the case with men as well, is that I don't introduce my parents to just anybody. I only introduce them to the people who are a serious relationship. And so I haven't had a serious relationship with a woman, so I haven't really bothered to tell them. And he's like, maybe you should tell them. And I'm like, oh yeah, I probably should tell them something. I'm like, oh, when you're in this like very heteronormative relationship, it's like, oh, maybe, yeah, I'll get around to it one day. Because I think my parents see it, like, if I was in a same-sex relationship, my dad had said a long time ago, like, oh, if I was in a same-sex relationship, how would you feel? And I think he said, oh, I would be sad, but I would love you anyway. I think for him, it's more about him being sad that potentially I'd have a more difficult time as somebody who was, you know, of LGBTQ, you know, things like having a child kind of thing. But obviously, that's not stopped you.
So. No. Beauty of modern science.
The other thing is that my parents have watched the show Pose. Have you watched Pose?
No, I haven't.
It's a great TV show. It's set in like the 80s, 90s New York, and it's a show centered around these Black and Latino trans women right around the peak of the HIV AIDS epidemic. And these women are all from like ballroom culture, and so they're all like voguing and all that kind of stuff, so that each week they have like competitions and all that. And so the story is just following these women who are, you know, living their trans lives, and it does expose a lot of the issues that they've had, like things with accessing healthcare and like safe housing and all the things that are very difficult about being a Black Latino trans woman in the 80s and 90s. And so my parents, they just got really hooked on this show. They were like, oh, it's so great. And they were the ones who introduced me to the show because they were like, oh, these women, they're so beautiful. Like, wow, it was so difficult for these people back in the 80s, 90s, blah, blah, blah. Trans people deserve to have good lives too and all that kind of stuff. So it just goes to show, not that my parents were ever anti-trans or anything like that. They just never had exposure. And then they watched this really well-produced TV show that had cast trans women as trans women. Mm. And that really exposed my parents to that, to what the life of a trans person is.
Mm. Like representation, right? I think it's all about representation. And I'm really glad to see, like, even just Asian people playing Asian people roles. Like,
oh my gosh, yes.
That Matt Damon isn't going to be a Japanese samurai fighter or whatever he was. Yeah. And like you said, like the trans thing and like Elliot Page coming out and them writing his role differently in Umbrella Academy and stuff and actually writing that into...
Oh, that'll be so exciting to see.
Yeah, writing
so
that into...
in how they'll do it.
The storyline, that's how people get heard and tell stories. Just normalizing it for the next generation. It makes me excited for young people who just seem to find a lot of courage to just be who they are now. I guess we just feel safer doing that. Yeah. And like I said, finding other people around who are, even if I'm just following your stories as a bystander on Instagram, it's still seeing that normality there and that kind of also the progression on, you know, testosterone and like seeing how they've gone. Yeah. So that's exciting for me personally, but yeah, still a bit freaky.
If I was a trans person heading in that direction and wanting gender-affirming care, like how would I go about accessing it?
Yeah, and I guess at the moment, as with every DHB, it depends on where you're at. Like our one at the moment is that you get a referral to a...
So you have to see a GP first, right?
Yeah, your GP, they refer you to a counselling service as well as the endocrine. And we've just been discussing that there are other pathways that other people do. So like Canterbury do it, Christchurch do it a different way. They have this kind of hub that's set up for transgender care. So what we're thinking about doing in Taranaki is because at the moment you have to do counselling and then you get the endocrine appointment. But what would be really a lot safer, I think, for the community is some people don't want to do counselling for various reasons and it shouldn't be a mandatory thing. Someone like me who's probably obviously thought about it for a long time and understands the risks and benefits of transitioning. So essentially, yeah, that's generally the thing. You get to an endocrine and then, well, once you get to an endocrine...
What's the wait time specifically in your DHB? Like how many counselling sessions, how long until you get the endocrine appointment?
So I probably did in a little bit of a cheeky way. I was seeing my endocrine for a diabetes appointment anyway. And at the end of it, I was like, by the way, I'm not trying to jump the queue or anything, but it was more that I knew she would be involved down the track. So I wanted to give her a heads up that, look, I haven't read a lot of research about diabetes and transitioning, especially how it's going to affect. Like when I used to be on the pill, it really mucked up my blood sugar levels. And so I don't know if tea will do the same or if it'll actually be better because I won't have a progesterone period in my cycle. So I just sort of said to her, I've tried to research and I think I'm a very niche person. Just if you knew any information about it, that would be great. Or point me towards any research or anything. And actually, she was really lovely. I was a bit nervous, to be honest. It's a small town and a new endocrine. The previous one was very good at doing gender affirming care, but he just resigned. And this one was fresh. It's not something that she specializes in necessarily. And I was actually really pleased with her response because I said to her, I was trying to get my diabetes a bit better before I did this, but I still think that I actually just need to start it. Like I'm always waiting for my diabetes to be better, so I couldn't be waiting forever. And so she actually said to me, it's really important to get you feeling like yourself because you're right, and your other health otherwise is not going to be at its optimum if you don't feel like yourself. So she was actually the one who referred me to the counselling services. So I have my first appointment next week. They called me maybe 2 weeks ago and had apologised that they took so long. So maybe it's supposed to be within the month you get counselling. Like it took me maybe about a month or so to get that first appointment. I don't know if I have to do all six. My understanding was that there's just like a health questionnaire that they go through with you. And once you've done that, then they just refer it back to the endocrinologist and you can get started. Yeah. And I think from my friends here who are trans, one or two that I know, they said that the counselling services was actually probably more related to like more youth people who had their families involved and talking through family dynamics and like counselling the family through the process as opposed to focusing on the trans person. So I'm hoping it's only going to be like one session and we took off a whole bunch of questions and then I get the appointment with the endocrine.
Yeah. Wow. I think for some people they get all up in arms about if we make it available, then like anybody with like a bit of a mental health issue is going to just transition just like that, which is the very oversimplification of the process, right? I think people don't understand wait lists in the public, right? Like it takes so long. Like if somebody who didn't have, you know, type 1 diabetes wanted to access endocrine care for it, first they're going to have to see their GP, which may take 2 or 3 weeks. And then when they're after they're referred, they might not be seen for another 3 months.
Yeah.
And then it's not like people are going to start hormone therapy on the first appointment. For you, I guess you're lucky that you already know your endocrinologist, right? So like she knows you and she isn't going to have to go through all that background medical history with you. But for the general public, if you want to transition, it's not like you can just go to any old doctor and they'll start you on hormone pills straight away.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's why we're really interested in trying to make a model that works in the community, which I hope we can roll out everywhere in New Zealand. But the discussion with the DHB and the GP services is to create, the GP has a special interest in transgender care, and we can create this hub and connect kind of psychologists with it. And it can actually be a GP initiated thing because it's not a hard thing to do at all. It's just the set doses. You don't even have to go and calculate whatever. And it's 3 monthly blood tests after that. And so how difficult can it be? But I guess because we don't get any teaching on it in medical school, let alone, I guess, even as GPs and everything, you don't get any education in it. So it's a scary place for most GPs. That's why we want to, as our charity, kind of work on really educating the medical workforce. Because some of these things, like you said, time is money, right? These people who are dealing with this and have a lot of mental stress with it. Even myself, as someone who I think is pretty resilient, it's been tough to like work through all that. Like obviously I had to dig up a lot of other previous trauma, but I can only imagine someone who can't advocate for themselves, isn't educated like I am as a medical person. And even when I am, I still didn't know how to access the care. There was no clear pathway. And it must be like that in most DHBs. And so if you're just a person out in rural Taranaki, how are you going to know where to go for the support? And like you very rightly said, we have a huge GP shortage all around the country, but especially like Taranaki, people just can't get in, can't even enroll in one. I just saw a patient the other day in ED who moved from Auckland 3 years ago and couldn't enroll in one here. And I'm like, how the hell have you been getting your prescriptions? I just had to email my Auckland doctor and he's come in with an exacerbation of asthma because he's just has no doctor. Can't fly to Auckland just to see a doctor. Yeah, so hopefully the future of for transgender, that's not even broaching the topic of surgical transitioning, which is horrendous. The wait list is, you're never going to get on. Yeah. You're not even going to get on like the list. Everyone I know has self-funded their surgeries. I know no one who has a publicly funded surgery.
Your organisation that you're talking about, is it Pride in Health?
Yeah, so alongside 5 other GPs, we've created this essentially education toolbox. Hopefully our website's almost done. The vision of it is, I guess, to have it available for people just to look up kind of everything they need to know about queer health in New Zealand. So not just transgender health, but like HIV PrEP prescription and things like that, reproduction, how you go about doing that in New Zealand. Essentially, what I really want to do though is just see GP practices and all practices and all medical places be rainbow friendly. And it's like educating the whole team though. We know that people in the rainbow community have disproportionately high rates of mental illness and suicide and also not see the doctor for a lot of their things because I don't feel safe. If I end up having a beard and I go into ED with abdominal pain and still have a uterus, like people have got to learn to start thinking about like gynecological problems for people who are male presenting and same the other way and keeping people who are male presenting on like smears and things like that.
So, yeah. What do you think? Because, you know, in like medical records and stuff, up top we have your demographics and all your name, your date of birth, blah, blah, blah. And you have male or female. You know, do you think that we should be changing it to include things like trans man or like trans woman as like a flag so that you as a trans man wouldn't have to like remind people that you're a trans man every time you seek healthcare?
Yeah, potentially. I think it definitely has to have more than that. You definitely have to add things like non-binary and intersex and all those that I think is really important for health professionals to know about. I can see how it would be helpful to know that especially if you're just coming into ED and like the scenario of someone with abdo pain. But maybe like in a special box somewhere. I guess the only thing is that I would think about what I want to be referred to as. I just wonder whether or not people who are trans would feel less than, if you know what I mean? If you have to refer them to as trans, because I guess for me, I just feel like
if we put you in the situation where you are now male presenting, like you say, you've got a beard, you look very male presenting, anybody who sees you on the street will think, oh, this is a man. And like you say, you've presented to the emergency department with abdominal pain. How would you want things to be managed in a way that's like trans appropriate? Would you feel that it's the onus is on you to tell the healthcare workers that you're trans, or do you feel like the healthcare workers should be asking every single person whether or not they're like trans or like, you know, not trans? Do you know what I mean? How can we make it easier and more streamlined to deliver gender affirming care for things that are not to do with transitioning?
Actual transitioning. Yeah.
Yeah.
I get you. And I think it should be somewhere quite obvious on the front page. Like, say, if you use MedTech in the community or like Concerto, like, or Eclair, or whatever we use in the hospital. I've always thought that on there should just have somewhere for pronouns. So it's not just like Mr. Mrs. You should just have they, them. Like at my ED, they've just created on the ED board a purple colour for someone non-binary, which is great. Like my head of department's really, he's really good about it. Unfortunately, most people when they first saw it, it was like, oh, why is that person purple? And then just keep referring to them as she. It's, I don't know. Maybe we should have, I haven't actually thought about that, Nina. But I guess for me, I think that you want people to know that about you without it being like everywhere. Yeah. Like, and I don't know how
to be
like,
something
as relevant
you want that
people
to be
know
something
about
you, but not the only thing.
Yeah. And I guess in a GP setting, hopefully your GP would know that you're going through this with all the documentation that's there.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, in those, all the things that happen all the time is you got somebody who's from a different DHB or somebody who's a traveler who's coming into your ED and there's nothing. There's nothing on the system.
Yeah.
How'd you go about it?
I think we need to think about that more, eh? And maybe, ask people in the trans community, how do you like, what are your experiences? Most of them will probably say, we just don't go to the hospital.
I'll leave it to you then. That's your project.
Yeah, I'll work on it.
We went to med school together, right? And we graduated 2017, which isn't that long ago. And yet I feel like we had very little education, didn't we?
Rainbow Youth came and talked for a little bit. And there was that humanities paper we could take.
There's so much to know about rainbow people as well as about trans, right? I was listening to this other podcast and they were talking about like the studies of trans people like after they've transitioned. Mm. And I don't know to what level they meant transitioned in terms of we talked about before about socially, legally, medically and surgically, right? At a bare minimum, this cohort of people that were surveyed must have been medically transitioned at least. And they looked at this whole group of people, thousands and thousands of trans people, and they surveyed them and they found that actually like less than 1% of those people had regretted transitioning. Because I think that's a big argument that people have who get up in arms about access to like medical and surgical transitioning. Like, oh, what these people just regret it. Like, they're probably just mentally unwell. And, you know, I guess one of them, you know, the studies show that people don't regret it. And number two, the mental health issues are probably related to not having the gender-affirming care that they need.
Mm. Exactly.
Mental health.
Yeah. I think in that case, we definitely know what's the chicken and the egg. Like, it's just pretty obvious. I only know one person who's detransitioned, but he was male to female. And this was back in when I was dating my American ex. So I was an American guy. But he detransitioned for spiritual reasons because God suddenly told him it was not okay. No one else I know of. It's kind of like the same thing as when gay marriage came into New Zealand, right? Oh my gosh, this is going to be the doom of all marriages. And I always just used to think, if your marriage was doomed by other people getting married, then there's something wrong with your marriage. Like, it was just so ridiculous that the church could fall apart because of that. If you don't believe in gay marriage, don't be gay married then. Like, just go marry your heterosexual partners.
And like, how much of being trans do you think that people who are trans feel it is about like the biological hormones and genitalia kind of thing versus society and gender norms and things like that?
That's a good question, actually. I definitely have actually thought about that. And I can't answer that question for other people. I think I've actually always, like we talked about bisexuality, and I've actually come to realize that I don't know if I am. I think the guys that I liked, I think I wanted to be them. And it would be interesting once I transition whether or not I do still find guys attractive, because I don't think I found a guy attractive for years now because I've been more who I want to be. And I think back to like my relationship with my boyfriends, and I'm like, I wanted to buy those shirts for them because I wanted them for myself, you know? And like the hairs, the haircut they had and the cologne I bought them. I probably had to ask myself, what do I have to gain from this? Because I actually feel like I'll lose a lot. I'm very scared about losing my family, as I said. Like my mum doesn't know. I don't know how to talk about this in Chinese. I don't know how to tell my family back in Taiwan, who, although were pretty accepting of Shan, like being trans is a completely different thing. My brother who's gay, I haven't actually talked to about because I think he won't understand, even though he's part of the rainbow community. So I do actually feel like I stand to lose a lot. And a part of me said to myself, why don't I just keep myself as non-binary? I can just pass as this kind of dress in my shirt, a nice tie. And now I feel comfortable wearing ties out. Like I still remember the first time I wore a tie as a female presenting person, and it was on a date with Shan. And I was really super aware that people were looking at me wearing a tie. But like, I love wearing ties. The best thing about going to a private school when I was in primary school was I get to wear a tie every day. So I think the more I say those kind of things, the more I'm like, yeah, no, I actually just want to be a guy, and not for the privilege, because what privilege would it actually give me? Because actually, to be honest, I probably would end up still being more misunderstood because of it. And so am I ready to face the misunderstanding? And if I say that I am, it probably means that I want more than just the perks that being male presenting might give me.
Totally. We want some of those perks, and we want the men to share them. Can they? What are the things that you wish that like the general public like knew better about the struggles or like the trans experience and how things could be done better?
We are all capable of learning more about different things. It would just be really nice if people don't need to wait until they somehow hear someone's story, but then to go away and reflect on that and think about it and read up about it. And I think also to really understand that if anyone tells you that, it's super important for us to not judge that. And I know that sounds so basic, but like this is coming from someone who's obviously had a lot of judgment. If I trust you enough to tell you something about myself and you are my good friend, then I would hope that there's a genuine acceptance. You're constantly coming out to every single person you meet, whether you want to or not. It's just, it can get so tiring and it can get so invasive. And then people always go, oh, what's this about pride? Why do you always have to wave your pride flag? Like, why do you always have to talk about your relationship and what sexuality you are? If you're uncomfortable about something someone's told you, try not project that onto that person who's actually taken a lot of strength and courage to tell you something. Go read up on it, reflect on it, and try and ask questions.
Your journey with your previous Pentecostal evangelical Christian faith. I kind of want to know, to people who are maybe in a similar situation to what you had, other young people who are LGBTQ who don't know that they are yet or think that they are but aren't comfortable with coming out or feel shame in it because of the community that they're in. What's your advice to them?
Gosh, it always makes me sad thinking about it because I know how much struggle that they must be going through. Even if they don't know they're struggling, there's an eternal war that battled inside me for years until I finally accepted that I was bi. And it's about loving yourself. Like, it's hard to go to sleep at night if you hate everything in you and you're just wanting everything about you to change. Whether or not that was as a kid growing up praying that I would be a guy, to in my teens praying that I would not have feelings for girls. It was just a constant struggle. If anyone ever wants to reach out to me to ask, that's fine, like personally, because I think it's really important to know someone who's been through it. I think most of the stories I know about of people coming out in church environments is actually pretty supportive. I would say probably 90% of the people I know who are gay Christians have found it pretty supportive in their church environment, but they are generally in churches that are more conservative, more Anglican and whatnot. Yeah, I don't know. Good luck. It sounds terrible. But yeah, I think at the end of the day, I know people like I've dated who have married men because they didn't think they could ever be gay. And my heart goes out to them because I know that they're not happy in their marriages. But of course, the thing with Pentecostal Christianity is also it has this story of you've got to suffer for Christ. So I think you can also get lost in that narrative that what you're doing now on this earth is just preparing you for a better future in heaven. And so you can go along with it. I think for me, I was just brave enough and I was trusted my relationship with God and trusted my depth of faith to go, actually, I'm going to walk away from this just to see if God really exists and who I am as a person. Yeah, I would never, never imagined being married with a child, and most same-sex couples probably wouldn't ever imagine that as well.
If you could give some advice or talk to your 20-year-old self, what would you say?
Get out of there as quick as you can. Maybe. Don't waste another moment.
That's good advice. That sounds like good advice.
To be honest, I thought I was going to start a conversion therapy group myself. Like, I thought the whole reason I went into those gay relationships was because God was trying to teach me how to get out of it so then I could lead this ex-gay ministry. I honestly thought I was going to run there in New Zealand. So, like, I had a lot of stuff to work through in my life to get to a point where I could accept it in myself. I might just say you learn to love yourself more and you actually experience genuine happiness. So even when you have moments of, oh my gosh, I don't know how anything could get even worse, stick true to being authentic because it's worth it in the end. Friends really do come and go in your life, and I have opened myself to the fact that I do meet some really incredible people just by means of my work or like whatever.
Okay, one last question.
Okay.
What is your favorite dessert and why?
I think like a baked custard or like creme brulee or something that,
yeah,
wobbly in nature and saucy.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Why? I don't think I like wobbly. I do like a creme brulee. I love the crispy, the top.
You know, break into the top.
Like creme brulee, I do like.
Or like a really nice Black Forest gâteau, like a properly done one.
Yum.
Yeah.
Really looking forward to reading your autobiography. I'm all about the drama, as long as it's somebody else's drama.
Yeah, I have a lot of drama being my friend.
Very good, very good. Revolving Door Syndrome acknowledges Māori as tangata whenua and te tiriti o Waitangi partners in Aotearoa, New Zealand. We recognise the inequities and challenges faced by Indigenous and vulnerable groups and acknowledge our duty to work towards closing the gap.